Afternoon. For the appellant, we have Per Olson, and for the appellee, Gary Sussman. Is that right? Mr. Olson, please proceed. We have this case set for 10 minutes for each side. So if you'd like to make a rebuttal argument, stop while there's still some time on that clock in front of you.
You want to keep your voice up and pull that microphone towards you, please?
I would like to address this for a moment. One of the questions that the court asked of both parties before the court was the justification of telling us about the old mandate. And both parties, I think, rely on language in that case.
What is the mandate in this case? What is the mandate? What set of words and where are they and how do we know what the mandate is?
In this case? Yes. Well, the mandate itself is confirmed in part, taken in part, in the end, when there's no mandate. 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 There's no mandate.
The line at the bottom of an opinion, is that what we call it? It's not, there is a definition of mandate in the federal rules, and it's completely different, but there seems to be something that's being talked about in these rule of mandate cases, and I'm trying to get a handle on what it is exactly.
Well, I think the mandate itself is
Did you cite that in your brief?
I did.
Shea?
Yes, Shea. I-S-E-K-A-L-I. Although I cited it in the first question, it assumes, for the sake of argument, that the exception to the rule of law case doctrine also applies to the rule of mandate doctrine. And it actually relies upon bankruptcy for the Pelican case by the name of In re Priscilla.
Why don't you go back to that initial argument? Why should the exceptions to law of case apply to the law of the mandate if the law of mandate is jurisdictional? In jurisdiction, there's no such thing as being half pregnant or full pregnant. I mean, you either have jurisdiction or don't, right?
Well, I agree that's true. However, that's why I don't think it's truly jurisdiction. I think the cases that talk about from a lower court exercise jurisdiction, really what they're saying is,
when we've said on many occasions authority, and that authority usually means jurisdictional, why wouldn't we consider the mandate jurisdictional issues, that is, how much power we've given to the district court to act.
Well, I think in the Killington case itself, which I think uses the word jurisdictional, it also says the mandate is flexible.
Killington is really a different question. Killington is saying, how do we know what the mandate really was, given the fact that there was a limited issue before the court, and although that there's a broad statement in that tagline sentence, it has to be read in conjunction with, you know, what issues were before the court. But here, unlike in Killington, you can say whether you agree with this. I gather from your briefs that perhaps you don't, but at least on one reading, the exact issue that you would try to relitigate because there were new facts was decided here on, let's assume for now, in a different set of facts, but the facts that existed at the time. So if in Killington, that wasn't the problem. The problem wasn't that there was something that was decided. It was that there was something that wasn't decided, and did the court mean to encompass it or not?
Well, Your Honor, there have been other instances where this court has approved the lower going outside of the mandate, where there's been intervening law. And I find those examples for you. So I found at least two of these anecdotal evidence that the lower court saying, okay, I understand there was an intervening case in the last 3 minutes.
But our Planned Parenthood case specifically dealt with that problem and said no, right? Because there were two intervening cases.
Well, I think the Planned Parenthood case is complicated for a number of different reasons. I went back and looked at the lower court for one in that case and determined how exactly it came to that. It seemed like parties were really grasping at straws by the time they were before the Ninth Circuit for the last time. And really, the set of issues that they were trying to raise in the last appeal, a couple of them had been litigated and decided, and there was a handful of them that they had been litigated before. So it wasn't simply a rule of mandate issue, but trying to raise a fully new issue that had been.
So another question is whether the law of men of the case and the rule of mandate, whether one is horizontal and the other is vertical. Meaning that the rule of mandate is a rule that doesn't apply to us with respect to our own mandate. It applies to the district court with respect to ours. It's a hierarchical rule. And if that's the case, why should they have the same exceptions or the same scope?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's just the recognition of the fact that these situations do arise, that the parties don't necessarily have control over. And, I think certainly the cases that say there are exceptions, they say that the lower court really needs to exercise a lot of caution, and they really should be careful about not disrupting the higher court's ruling. But then they go on to say, in some of these cases, it really the appellate court has agreed to reconsider some mandate and send it back.
It can't be true that the district court has discretion whether to follow the rule of mandate or not. We have discretion. I mean, the law of the case is ultimately a discretionary doctrine. But in its rule of mandate guise, that can't be true, right? So it has to, at least to that degree, be a stricter rule.
Well, my view is that it's the same as the law of the case doctrine in that you don't have discretion to rule outside of the law of the mandate. Unless there is one of these exceptions that applies. And based on, I'll summarize it really quickly because I see I am out of time, but based on the way of the authority from the other circuits and from this appears as though the American is both the role of the man and applying these exceptions to the rule of the man, just as they do to the law of the case. So I'll sit down for now.
Thank you, sir. Okay, Mr. Sussman.
In the last appeal, this court remanded the district court to conduct an evidentiary hearing on a single disputed Scarlett told the defendant's trial lawyer, John Scarlett, she would testify unfavorably toward the defendant or whether he simply sent her away.
Because, first of all, the actual – if what we're calling the mandate is the official direction at the end of the opinion, it certainly is not clear, right? It says a mandate in part, vacate in part, and remand for an evidentiary hearing. That's all it says. All right. So do we agree at least that on the questions that we've been presenting to you, the more abstract questions, that the mandate has to be read against the opinion? It can't simply be read in the – all right. And that goes in both directions. I mean, there may be instances in which something that appears to be clear isn't so clear once you read the opinion. All right. All right. So then we have the statement that says, we vacate the district court's order denying Section 2255 petition to the extent the petition raises claims based on Storkel's mid-trial decision not to call Scarlett and remand for an evidentiary hearing. Now, if that were the end of this opinion, if there had been no further issue about the investigation claim, wouldn't it appear that that investigation claim would come within that rubric? In other words, these are very closely interrelated questions. The argument was that he shouldn't have made this representation and then not called her, which could have been fixed either by not making the representation or not calling her. A directive to have a hearing on, to the extent the petition raises claims based on Storkel's mid-trial decision not to call her, would certainly seem to encompass the question of whether he shouldn't have made the representation if he wasn't going to call her. There's more in the opinion. I mean, up to that point, do you agree? I mean, what if there had been nothing else that happened? What if that was the end of the original opinion? Right. So it's not the mandate that's bothering you, then. It's not either that statement, that is, we vacate the district court order, or the final line. It's really a law of the case consideration, i.e., we then went on and decided something specifically on this question.
Absolutely.
All right. So what we're dealing with here is a law of the case problem, not a rule of mandate problem, or they're all the same?
I think that the analysis ends up being the same under both. I understand that in your consent and bad error case, you probably the analysis would be different in certain circumstances of these. However, I think under the facts of this case and the procedural posture of this case and the opinion that issued the last time, in this case, the bottom line analysis is the same. Whether you analyze it under the law of the case or the rule of mandate.
Well, why don't you lose then? At least, I mean, not necessarily on the merits, but at least as to the question of whether the issue should have been considered, because there is a new evidence exception to the law of the case. And here there was at least some new evidence. Whether it mattered or not is something for the judge to decide, but why shouldn't he have decided it?
Well, because the district court viewed this as essentially recharacterizing a claim already decided by this court. This court in this last...
Yeah, but there's an... if you look at it that way, there is a new evidence exception to the law of the case.
But this is a newly discovered evidence. This was evidence that was in the defendant's possession after trial, but before sentencing. That appears in counsel's own affidavit to the district court. The acknowledgement receiving the ATF report, which is...
Well, it was in the possession of the defendant's counsel who he's accusing of ineffective assistance.
No. This is counsel, this is current counsel, who says in his affidavit to the district court, we can support a motion for reconsideration. He says that he received that ATF report as part of the file received from this disorder after trial and before sentencing. Now, he did that at the time of sentencing. He did not raise that issue.
So basically, you would suggest that we decide this on the very narrow ground that the law of the case applies here, but there's no applicable exception because it was not new evidence. Is that really what you're saying?
No. That's part of what I'm saying, but it goes beyond that. And what it is at its core, the defendant is described to the district court in a pleading. He says that his claim is, here I'm quoting, at its core, the defendant's claim is that the trial counsel failed to perform an adequate investigation before trial as to Ms. Starkle's testimony. Now, he's saying now that Starkle was on notice or should have been on notice that Ms. Starkle would not have testified as Mr. Starkle anticipated she was going to. That is court, as the defendant himself acknowledges, a failure to investigate claim. What is it? And it's not that. You didn't check her out well enough before you mentioned her during your opening.
Well, that's right. But if it's a law of the case problem, there would be an exception for new evidence. So the only way we could decide this case on this issue would be to say that there was no new evidence.
Not necessarily. You could also affirm the district court that the district court found that the ATF report didn't make a difference in the final.
Well, that's the merits. But that's the merit.
That's right.
Let me ask you a question, if I could. Are you taking the position that the rule of mandate is a jurisdictional aspect?
I am. The rule of mandate.
Just yes is fine. That's fine. Let me go on to my next question. Ordinarily, if there's a jurisdictional question, we're directed by the Supreme Court to address that first. So by that, we'd have to address it first before we got to the rule of mandate. Or the rule of the case, law of the case. And if you're right, then we would never get to the law of the case if you're right on the rule of mandate. Right?
That's correct.
Now, the way that counsel gets by the rule of mandate is by saying the exceptions in the law of the case are also exceptions to the rule of mandate, which we haven't held yet. That's his argument. Well, your response to that is what?
My response to that is, because the court has suggested that it's jurisdictional, there can't be no exceptions. As you pointed out earlier during counsel's argument, if this court issues a limited mandate to the district court to do one thing, in this case it's to hold an evidentiary hearing on one factual dispute,
no, I'm really baffled. You seem to be saying exactly the opposite of what you said before.
Could you let me finish the sentence? Isn't free to what? I didn't get the rest of the sentence.
Free to reopen and reconsider issues already decided on appeal by this court.
What difference would it make whether we've decided them or not if the mandate says do X? What difference does it make whether we've done Y? I don't get your point. Well, I understand this case is we've decided that, but that isn't the point I'm trying to get you to respond to. Without considering law of the case at all, your position is the rule of mandate disposes of it because it's jurisdictional. Why, in your opinion, do not the exceptions to the law of the case apply in rule of mandate?
Because that would create, in essence, a discretionary rule of mandate doctrine. And if this court tells the district court to do X, certainly this court is not going to invest the district court with the discretion as to whether to do X or whether to find an exception to X. If X is what this court orders the district court to do, then perhaps with the only exception being an intervening Supreme Court case that would render X illegal,
who says that as the intervening Supreme Court case extends our jurisdiction issue? You said except for an intervening Supreme Court case. I don't understand why you say except for.
Well, because if the rule of mandate category wouldn't be applied, we wouldn't be applied as the term used in footnote in the calendar. And if there was an intervening Supreme Court decision that was directly contrary to what was in the mandate,
all right,
and the district court followed it, then the district court would have acted in
precisely, and they would come up to us and say, you went down, we did exactly what you told us to do, that's all we had jurisdiction to do, now you solve the intervening case. By what authority do you have that because there's been case law of the Supreme Court or our court in bank or a conflict established between panels that all of a sudden jurisdiction is no longer jurisdiction? I don't understand that.
There is no case that holds that.
Yeah.
The closest we come is the footnote in Callendon where it says it should not be, wouldn't we apply to the use of absurd results? And Judge Berzon, reached essentially the same conclusion in her dissent in the Bad Marriage case. But she mandate required the district court to do something which would be illegal.
Remember, it was the dissent in the bad marriage case, not the majority.
It was, and I realize that reasonable minds are different because you were in the majority.
Shows that smart people can disagree, doesn't it? That'll get you back on track on this one. Go ahead.
The bottom line is, in this case, that this case was remanded for a resolution of that issue. It was all about the district court. And the resolution of that issue was not changed.
So let me go back for a minute. I really am confused because I thought when you and I were having a dialogue that we had gotten to the point of agreeing that this really wasn't a rule of mandate case because the mandate itself, neither the last line nor the direction to have an evidentiary hearing really addresses, it really precludes this determination. What really precludes it is the fact that the opinion then went on to decide it. And therefore, it's really a law of the case, not a rule of mandate case. And then when you were talking with Judge Wallace, you seemed to say otherwise. So which is it? Is it a rule of mandate case or is it law of the case? This case.
I think it's both. I think it's both. If you leave the mandate in the opinion, it is outside the mandate of this court or the district court to revisit an issue or decide. If that particular issue,
Mr. Sussman, we're well over the time allotted initially, but if my colleagues have other questions, we'll go on, and we'll then thank you for your argument. And Mr. Olson, we're going to add 2 minutes additional to your time because the questions took your colleague over his time. So.
First of all, to address the question of the ATF report, what we do for the last meeting, the Kellington case says, well, if you're considering what is the scope of the remand, what is the remand, you can look at the procedural history of the prior case, of the lower case, but depending on the substantive law and circumstances of the case. The circumstances in this case were that, because it's a Section 2255 case, we were extremely limited in the sort of discovery that we did. We were not entitled to discovery unless we asked the court for it. The court allows us to do depositions and so forth. And we had asked for that, and all motion to do that was denied. And we appealed that issue when the court actually ruled on that. But the point is, we were prohibited from really doing the normal sort of discovery that comes up in a civil case or in a criminal case, where facts can be developed.
Does the declaration, is it your declaration, show that you or whoever was the post-trial who did the 2255 had this information in his file? Had the ATF document?
We were aware that it was in his file. What we didn't know is when he had received it, because the date on the report is approved by the supervisor of the agent about 7 days started. So we didn't know when this control question received it, or if it would have been part of the normal government discovery. It wasn't necessarily a historical information. And we didn't know figure out the discrepancy between what she was telling the agent and what she had told the attorney's investigator previously. He didn't know if he had taken those sorts of steps. And therefore, and quite frankly, I was anticipating having an evidentiary hearing the first time and get into that. And because I was prohibited from having an evidentiary hearing all of the discovery at this point, get into that. We didn't have the right to have last time that we came before the court. And so the reason I mention all of this is that this court, for telling them, can look at procedural history, what was known to the parties,
bottom line is that you're arguing either that are you arguing that the new evidence exception applies to the rule of mandate, or you're arguing that the rule of mandate doesn't apply here, it's the law of the case, or what?
My first argument is that the rule of mandate, well, the rule of mandate always applies. Remember, there's a mandate.
But doesn't but this doesn't isn't in the mandate.
My first argument is that this, if the judge had ruled on this issue, it would not have deviated from the mandate. My second argument is is considered, would be considered a deviation from the mandate. He was authorized to do so as a
Mr. Olson, we appreciate your argument. Unless my colleagues have other questions, we'll bring it to a close.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. We thank both counsel. We also thank you, each of you, for traveling to Seattle for the argument, and we appreciated the arguments. USB Thrasher shall be submitted.